Starting something new isn't just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When I started this podcast, I wasn't even sure what I was doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys my products? I definitely made a fool of myself. Now I know that I was right in believing in myself and launching the podcast, despite all of the fears and the hesitations. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if I get stuck? Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And their app is just objectively super dope. It's easy to use, well-designed, and helps me keep tabs on the American Hauntings clothing store while I'm on the go, or if I'm just too lazy to stare at the big screen for any longer that day. And you can trust me, my 9-to-5 job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might get confused or break technology. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
When the headless corpse of a young pregnant woman was found on John Locke's farm near Fort Thomas, Kentucky on February 1st, 1896, the shock of the discovery was felt far beyond the Ohio River Valley. In fact, for the rest of that winter and most of the spring, the tragedy involving the murdered woman unfolded daily in newspapers across the country. That murdered young woman, it was eventually discovered, had boarded a train in central Indiana, bound for Cincinnati, just days before her body was found. When she'd climbed the steps onto the passenger car, she undoubtedly believed that her troubles were almost at an end. She simply needed a problem to go away. She was desperate, unmarried, and pregnant. And she was on her way to a faraway city where the father of her unborn child promised he had arranged for her an illegal abortion. But there would be no salvation for her. She would be betrayed and gruesomely murdered by the man she trusted. In most cases, a story like this would have faded into obscurity by now. It would have ended after her killer kept his date with the hangman. But this crime was different for several reasons. Mostly, it was tailor-made for the popular culture of the era. The horror of the crime, its characters, and its cause created a melodrama that could only be found in yellowback novels of the time. A villain deflowers a pretty young girl and then murders her to cover up her unplanned pregnancy so he can continue to live a life of debauchery. And then to make matters even more lurid, he cuts off her head to keep her from being identified. And her head is never found. Well, such a tragedy understandably resonated with the public, prompting stories, legends, and even a folk ballad. You see, this tale became a warning to young women of the era to practice chastity and to avoid the mortal sin of abortion, a crime so heinous, religious figures claimed, that the devil himself had a hand in its continued existence. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. As you're aware from previous episodes, our journey back in time is exploring the diabolical figure of the devil for now. He's the source of so many of America's fears. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 10, The Devil Will Pay. Diabolical imagery in the 19th century provided the majority of white Americans with a boundary line on which one side they found respectability purity and evil and sin on the other side. But throughout the century, dissident voices sought to challenge this understanding of evil. Many writers reflected a desire to untangle the devil from the American concept of evil altogether and force Americans to rethink their use of demonic imagery, which they'd applied to books, music, immigrants, and by the mid-century, the rights of women. America's literary set, from Mark Twain to Nathaniel Hawthorne, were not alone in their criticism of America's concept of the demonic and understanding of evil. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the powerful voice for women's rights in this period, attempted to revise traditional beliefs about the devil and place them in the service of liberation. Her 1895 project, The Woman's Bible, subverted the popular image of the devil and transformed him into a symbolic argument for the freedom of women. It was a dangerous idea, but Elizabeth had long believed that religion had been a primary partner in the patriarchy's oppression of all women. She noted in the preface to the book that when 19th century women first raised questions about the nature of their oppression, that they were, quote, referred to the Bible for the answer. She argued that only by challenging the authority of this allegedly sacred text, and challenging the religious patriarchy on its own field of battle, could women emancipate themselves from the hold that religion had over their lives. In the Women's Bible, the first three chapters of the book of Genesis received special attention from Elizabeth and her collaborators, mostly because this section had always been a favorite of misogynists. The so-called Sin of Eve had been regarded as the origin of male domination in the world, with childbirth and subservience to men being the punishment handed out to Eve for listening to the devil's temptation. Many even saw Adam's decision to eat the fruit from the tree of life as the result of him being seduced by his wife, which absolved him of the original sin. This made the opening chapters of the Bible what some feminists would later call, quote, a text of terror. Elizabeth read the story much differently. The serpent who speaks to Eve, traditionally interpreted by Christians to be the devil, is described by Elizabeth as a very different creature, one which offers the gift of knowledge to Eve, promising that if, quote, the mortal body does perish, the immortal part will live forever. The serpent then, in her opinion, was an angelic being that was only later imagined as the devil. The woman's action in partnership with the serpent is read as an act of bravery. Eve is fearless of death if she can gain wisdom. Meanwhile, Adam is the villain, whining to an angry God about his wife's behavior, using her as a shield for his own irresponsibility. Eve is not deceived by the devil. Instead, she makes a choice to partner up with a beautiful creature that's later cursed by the patriarchy as a serpent. Now, as you might imagine, Elizabeth's attempts to redact the theological history of the patriarchy fell flat during 19th century America, when powerful cultural forces turned every effort by American women to exercise agency outside of traditional marriage and family as, of course, the devil's work. A perfect example of this was Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president in 1872, at a time when women weren't even allowed to vote. Characterized by her many enemies as an advocate of free love, Victoria criticized what she described as the, quote, legalized prostitution of marriage that often bound women for life in abusive and unfulfilling legal contracts. She called for a massive overhaul of divorce laws that would take away the rights of a husband to claim his wife as property. Victoria herself, lambasted in the press, was painted as a demonic temptress who sought to destroy holy matrimony. In 1872, a Harper's Weekly cartoon portrayed Victoria with the long, leathery wings of a demon, urging an abused wife to leave her drunken husband. Later in the 1870s, Victoria was convicted of anti-obscenity laws that effectively silenced her calls for reform. And after this, Elizabeth Cady Stanton stopped discussing the topic in her public lectures, fearing the same fate as Victoria Woodhull. By the 1880s, many states even put further restrictions on divorce laws, that had been briefly loosened after the Civil War. But it was those obscenity laws, which had plagued Victoria Woodhull, that represented the larger wave of moral panic that washed over the country in the late 19th century. It was a cultural movement that differed from the concerns of earlier reformers, and that it focused less on the reform of social ills and more on the restriction of personal behavior. These new laws included, for the first time, efforts to limit women's access to birth control. Since the 1830s, there had been a flourishing trade in condoms, womb veils, an early name for diaphragms, and other devices that provided numerous options of often uncertain reliability for women and men to prevent pregnancy. They had given birth control a very public presence, and conservatives were worried that they created a cultural environment where sexual pleasure could thrive separately from reproduction and marriage, and they were determined to do something about it. At the start of this movement, a doctor named Nicholas Francis Cook predictably linked women's rights, sexual liberation, and birth control with the works of the devil. His book, Satan in Society, became the definitive anti-birth control text of the period, linking reproductive choices with, quote, immorality, indecency, and crime, which in Cook's view presented a demonic attack on America. He believed that birth control threatened the very foundations of the Republic and a satanic threat that would loosen the bonds of the American family. Birth control devices, he said, were, quote, inventions of hell that led to debauchery and ruin. But it was for abortion that the moral crusaders saved their greatest vitriol. Abortion actually has a long history in America, dating back to the colonial era. Although frowned upon by most, only the Puritans deemed it as a serious offense, although convictions for abortion were rare. There isn't enough evidence to show how common abortion was during the 18th and early 19th centuries, and for the most part, it seemed that parents welcomed any children they could have, despite the dangers of pregnancy and high infant mortality rates. And yet there were times when parents couldn't afford to have a child, or had pregnancies so close together they could be dangerous for the mother. Cases in which a child was clearly unwanted and a miscarriage occurred may be indication of an abortion, but due to the reluctance of people at the time to speak of such things, there's no way to know. By 1850, though, things had changed. Birth control had become commercialized, and women began to gain more independence in their choices about both birth control and abortion. This led to those campaigns of, quote, social purity, which were usually led by middle-class white men and women who sought to restore the public good, no matter what it took or who was hurt along the way. The campaigns proved successful, and soon state laws were created to make abortion a very serious crime. Some states made abortion at any stage in the pregnancy illegal, prosecuting women for second-degree murder and manslaughter. Some states made exceptions if abortions were done to save the mother's life. Previously, abortions had been misdemeanors, not felonies, and only then after movement was apparent in the fetus. By the 1880s, state laws varied greatly on the subject of abortion. In some states, like New York, the laws were very harsh and very clear. However, at least five states had no clear laws about abortion at all. The general rule was that they were nationally illegal, which drove them underground, making them very expensive and very dangerous. Remember those obscenity laws that we talked about earlier? They had been passed by Congress in 1873 and dubbed the Comstock Laws, named for their main proponent, a purity crusader named Anthony Comstock. The purpose of the laws was to tighten loopholes that allowed interstate trade in obscene literature and material. The law defined obscene material in a number of ways, including anything that prevented conception or caused an unlawful abortion. States used the law as a model as well, so that soon it became a serious offense to offer anything that might prevent or terminate a pregnancy in any way, regardless of the circumstances. In some states, it became a criminal offense to even talk about abortions. There were some exceptions, but in many cases, a doctor was not even permitted to discuss birth control or adoption with the patient, even if he was warning against it. But of course, none of these things stopped abortions from happening. Some of the advice for unwanted pregnancies was to simply take part in activities that were believed to cause a miscarriage, like long walks, climbing of any kind, or rigorous carriage or wagon rides. This way, a woman could claim ignorance even though she might have engaged in the activity in hopes of ending a pregnancy. Abortion drugs also existed, and many were often ancient in origin. They were prescriptions that had more to do with magic than medicine, such as rubbing certain areas with the dried skin of a snake or carrying certain stones. There were drugs derived from saffron, mace, and rue that were said to remove an unwanted child. Other drugs came from known poisons and were said to kill the fetus and then the body would naturally expel it. There was also the well-known use of pennyroyal tea. As global trade expanded, these herbal remedies became common. Well, until the Comstock laws. Before that, women could easily purchase these through the mail, answering ads in newspapers and magazines of the day. Even after Comstock, companies still advertised, but the ads were purposely vague and only indicated that the product was a, quote, married woman's helper or some other euphemism. Exotic plants were presented as guaranteed abortion aids, while miracle drugs like cocaine, heroin, and others were said to help as well. And then, of course, there were the surgical procedures. Thanks to the illicit nature of the operations, abortionists were shadowy figures. A woman going in for an abortion had no idea what to expect and was, quite literally, putting her life in the hands of a stranger. Such procedures were hard to come by, especially after the social purity campaigns of the late 19th century. An abortion by a well-regarded practitioner might cost as much as $500, a sum that only the very wealthy could afford. A less reputable back-alley abortionist could charge as little as $5, but we have to wonder what such an operation entailed and how dangerous it was. An abortion done in secrecy, conducted by someone with little or no skill, could easily lead to the eventual death of the mother, probably after a long and agonizing battle with infection. As the fight against abortion ramped up, though, many of its opponents abandoned the moral elements of the public discussions of the issue and simply deployed the image of satanic evil in their attacks. No matter what the law said, these self-appointed moral crusaders were determined not to allow something they hated so much to exist, whether it personally affected them or not. They couldn't worry about that. They were too busy branding both abortion providers and the women seeking help as demonic monsters. The old folk tradition of monstrous births returned. In the lore, this was a child so malformed it was considered a literal monster. Such births were interpreted as omens, signs from God, or moral warnings, which of course the religious used as a tool of manipulation. The tradition returned as a way to punish women who tried to end their pregnancies. Various true crime papers in America's cities reported on dead women and deformed births as a result of abortion. The New York Police Gazette often printed stories about botched abortions and the ruined lives and health of the women who received them. One infamous issue of the Gazette featured a graphic illustration of an abortion client with a monstrous demon devouring her womb. Abortion reformers used such powerful imagery when they began their campaign to convince those 30 state legislatures to ban abortion altogether. The American Medical Association joined in the efforts to stamp out what they called, quote, an unwarranted practice. The motives of those involved in the bans were mixed. Horatio Stoner, perhaps the first important anti-abortion crusader in the country, called abortion a, quote, crime against life. But he also seemed to have believed, through some sort of tortured logic, that the easy availability of abortions would mean the death of the white race. Storer, noting that white Protestant women had more frequent abortions than Catholics, worried that this would lead to the, quote, low, ignorant, and alien, overwhelming the white population. It boils down to the fact that the portrayal of women and their desires as demonic has a long history in America too, stretching back to the New England witch trials. The abortion debate entered the American mainstream in the mid-19th century and, of course, has never gone away. The effects of those unforgiving abortion laws in the late 1800s proved disastrous to the health of women, with thousands dying each year due to complications from underground abortions. But as William Faulkner once wrote, quote, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." Make of that what you will. But in 1896, the moral campaign against abortion was going strong, and the newspapers, which weren't above making up stories that served the purpose of their supporters, found themselves in the unique position of having a story to tell that didn't require creating fiction. It was a terrifying story that quickly became a cautionary tale for young women, turning what was simply a sad story of murder into a melodramatic warning against promiscuity, loose morals, and going away with strangers. When the two young men who worked for John Locke stumbled across the body of a headless woman in an orchard at the edge of the road, they immediately informed their employer and the authorities about what they'd found. The body was taken to the Cincinnati morgue, and efforts began to try and discover who she might be. Although privately, police officers doubted her identity would ever be known. Because she was found so close to the fort, a missing prostitute or a dance hall girl seemed the most likely candidate for the corpse, with her killer being one of the soldiers stationed at Fort Thomas. But amazingly, especially for 1896, the mystery was solved very quickly. L.D. Pook, a local shoe store owner, took an interest in the shoes the victim was wearing and discovered that inside one boot was the imprint of a shoe store in Greencastle, Indiana. He also spotted what he knew to be the manufacturer's lot number. After a little investigation, the shoe factory told him the date of the shipment to Greencastle and that there was only one size that matched that of the victim in the lot. This sent Campbell County Sheriff Jules Plummer and two Cincinnati police detectives to Greencastle and to the Lewis and Hayes shoe store, which checked their records and saw the shoes had been purchased a few months earlier by a young woman named Pearl Bryan. Late that night, her parents identified Pearl's clothing and learned about their daughter's awful death. Although Pearl was easily identified by her shoes, who the young woman really was is just one of the many mysteries in the story that will never be solved. In the newspaper, she was portrayed as a poor, innocent farm girl, seduced and ruined by an older man. But while she was a farmer's daughter, none of the rest of that was true. Pearl's father was the wealthiest man in Greencastle. She lived in one of the town's finest homes and was no naive farmer's daughter. The pretty blonde 22-year-old was a music student at DePaul University. She also worked in her sister Mary's dress shop, making sure they stocked all of the latest big city fashions, so she was undoubtedly not unsophisticated. When she left town in late January 1896, she told her parents she was going to Indianapolis to visit some family friends, but went instead to Cincinnati, where she planned to have an abortion. When it was discovered that Pearl was pregnant when she was killed, her family and many of her friends first assumed that Will Wood, Pearl's second cousin, was the father. Will had known Pearl his whole life, and the two had always been close. Though popular with the boys, Pearl had no regular boyfriend, and Will was always around. Others, though, believed that Pearl was having a secret romance with Scott Jackson, a slightly older young man who'd come to Greencastle from New Jersey a year earlier. Jackson was friends with Will Wood, who lived with his mother next door to the church where Will's father was the pastor. At the time of Pearl's death, Jackson was studying dentistry in Cincinnati, just a short trip across the Ohio River from the spot where the body was found. Jackson quickly became the prime suspect. He was arrested outside his rooming house in Cincinnati, and Will was detained for questioning. After initially denying everything, Jackson eventually admitted that Pearl had come to Cincinnati for an abortion that he was supposed to arrange, but only as a favor for his friend Will, who'd gotten her pregnant. Will, of course, said the opposite, that it was Jackson who was responsible for his cousin's pregnancy. Which of these two was the father of Pearl's child was never wholly established, but Jackson later admitted on the witness stand that he'd had sex with Pearl. He claimed, though, that it hadn't occurred until Christmas of 1895, when he was home from school and already knew she was pregnant. Will denied ever sleeping with Pearl, but Several witnesses later swore that he bragged in detail about his sexual encounters with her. So while neither of these men were exactly reputable, there was one more character that has to be added to the story. His name is Alonzo Walling. He was Jackson's roommate in Cincinnati. He was also arrested after Jackson said he left Pearl in his care and that he was supposed to arrange the abortion. Jackson claimed that Walling had murdered her instead. Walling, of course, told a different story. He claimed that Jackson told him he planned to lure Pearl to Cincinnati by telling her he'd pay for an abortion, but then he was going to poison her, cut her body into pieces, and scatter them around in outhouses throughout the city. Now, was this yet another wild story, or was it Jackson's actual plan? Who knows? Both men denied being responsible for Pearl's murder and blamed her death on the other one. Without confessions, the police began building a case against the two men based on testimony from witnesses who had seen them with Pearl during the week before her death. The witnesses included a clerk at a piano store and a spiritualist medium who said that Jackson accompanied Pearl to her home for a séance. I assume she was not a very good spirit medium, though, since she didn't warn Pearl that she was about to be murdered. In addition, Pearl Jackson and Walling were also seen at a saloon in the city by owner Dave Wallingford and his porter, who also saw them getting to a cab outside the bar. The police eventually tracked down the cab driver, a man named George Johnson, who said he'd been approached by Walling, who offered him $10 to drive Walling, a doctor, and a patient across the bridge into Kentucky. They were driving away from the saloon when Johnson heard the woman moaning inside his cab. He tried to stop, not wanting to get involved in any trouble, and tell his passengers to get out, but he said Walling threatened him with a pistol. Johnson drove on, but when they reached their destination, the two men took the woman into some woods, and George quickly fled back to Cincinnati. To the authorities, the case against the two men seemed rock solid, with an unbroken string of eyewitnesses who took them from the saloon to the farm in Kentucky, but as they soon discovered, the case wasn't quite as solid as it seemed. Jackson and Walling both admitted being at Wallingford's saloon with Pearl, but claimed it had been one night earlier than the witnesses claimed. As further proof of that, both the tavern owner and George Johnson, the cab driver, said Scott Jackson was wearing a full beard when they saw him. He'd been wearing a beard for at least 6 months, in fact. But Jackson testified that he'd shaved his beard off on the afternoon before he visited the tavern with Pearl and Walling. His barber corroborated this. As suspicious as it seemed that Jackson shaved off his beard on the day Pearl died, completely changing his appearance, he couldn't have been seen with a full beard in the saloon that night. Also, when Pearl's body was found, she was wearing a checkered house dress that her mother had made for her sister Jenny, handed down to Pearl when Jenny died. It was not a dress worn outside the house, and would surely not have been worn to a saloon by someone as concerned about fashion as Pearl had been. But it was the cab driver's story that turned out to be the most controversial. The first mystery is why the two would have hired him in the first place, essentially paying him to be a witness to the murder they planned to commit. George brought his story to the police 2 weeks after it occurred, which was plenty of time to study newspaper pictures of the prisoners, but even so, he had a hard time picking them out of a lineup. His reputation as a con artist and attention seeker also cast doubt on his story. Even his employer expressed the belief that he was lying. And to throw in one more bit of doubt, after he testified at Scott Jackson's trial, George was tried in an unrelated case and convicted of perjury. However, the district attorney went ahead with the prosecution, and both men were separately put on trial. Jackson and Walling each testified in their own defense, but neither added anything to what they'd been saying all along, that they didn't know what happened to Pearl after she was last seen 3 days before her death. Neither jury believed them, and both men were convicted and sentenced to death. Both appealed, but the verdicts were upheld, and a double hanging was scheduled for March 20, 1897. But before they could be hanged, the press, public, and the prosecution wanted the truth from them. They needed a confession to justify the executions, and besides that, they really wanted to know what they'd done with Pearl's head, which had never been found. After their appeals were lost and the date for their executions drew closer, Jackson and Walling decided their only hope was to tell all and plead with the governor for mercy. Specifically, Walling could be saved if Jackson told the truth. The public didn't doubt Jackson's guilt, but there was a growing belief that Walling's crimes had been a lesser one and had only been committed due to Jackson's influence. 2 days before the men were scheduled to hang, they were placed in a room together, given pencils and paper, and were ordered to write their confessions. The separate statements told basically the same story, starting with Pearl's arrival in Cincinnati for an abortion. Walling said he contacted Mae Smith, his girlfriend at the time, and asked for the name of a doctor willing to perform the illegal operation. She sent him to George Wagner of Bellevue, Kentucky, and arrangements were made to send Pearl to his house. On January 29th, Walling met Pearl in Cincinnati and gave her directions, sending Pearl to see Dr. Wagner by herself. The next day, Jackson and Walling delivered Pearl's suitcase to her in Bellevue, and they returned the following day for the operation. Both men stated there had been complications from the start. Pearl seemed to be in terrible pain, and so the doctor sent Jackson to the drugstore for something to give her some relief. But it didn't help. Then the doctor opened her dress, injected her with some kind of clear liquid, and gave her whiskey to drink. Pearl became unconscious after that and didn't wake up. Dr. Wagner soon announced that she was dead. Jackson and Walling then loaded her body into the wagon and took her to a secluded spot, where Dr. Wagner severed her head to prevent her from being identified. He had the head taken away with him, both men insisted. And after that, the pair were driven across the bridge, back into the city, and they went their separate ways. Well, no one was happy with the confessions. Jackson didn't admit guilt, he didn't exonerate Walling, and they'd also implicated a prominent doctor in their story. Obviously, he had nothing to do with any of it, the public insisted. But not so fast. When the confessions were printed in the newspaper, Walling's girlfriend, Mae Smith, came forward and confirmed that she'd sent Walling to see Dr. Wagner. The druggist at the store near Wagner's home confirmed he'd filled a prescription for a painkiller on the night in question and added he'd received telephone messages from Scott Jackson to Maud Wagner, the doctor's daughter, earlier that week. Well, the confessions were unpopular, but they were becoming more credible. It also couldn't be denied that there had been rumors of the Wagner's family's involvement in Pearl's death even before Jackson's trial. His attorneys subpoenaed Anna, Nellie, and Maud Wagner, the wife and two daughters of Dr. Wagner, but they were never called to testify. Dr. Wagner himself couldn't be subpoenaed because shortly after Pearl's body was found, he was committed to the Eastern Kentucky Asylum for the Insane. These new additions to the story were sensational, but they also had some flaws. Mae Smith was already a familiar figure in the case. Earlier on, she told the press that she had letters from Scott Jackson in which he admitted his guilt. The next day, though, she recanted, claiming she was drunk when she told the story. Mae probably had some knowledge of the mess, but was considered too unreliable to testify for either the defense or the prosecution. The druggist had already testified at Jackson's trial. He was one of several witnesses who could put Jackson, Walling, and Pearl together in Kentucky, but during the trial, he'd made no mention of the prescription or the telephone messages when he was on the stand. It was also later discovered that he and Dr. Wagner had a long-standing feud. The Wagners were outraged by the accusations, and they produced telegrams that proved that Dr. Wagner had been at his father-in-law's home many miles away on the night of Pearl's death. The doctor was so angry that he was pronounced cured of his insanity so he could go home and address the situation. The confessions were sent to the governor, but he wasn't impressed. He saw no reason to overturn the death sentences of Jackson and Walling, and the hangings took place on March 20th, just as they'd been scheduled. The executions of Scott Jackson and Alonzo Walling essentially closed the book on the Pearl Bryan case, but I'm not convinced that story is really finished. Jackson and Walling were certainly not innocent of Pearl's death, but the evidence used to convict them was questionable at best. Worse, despite the best efforts of the police and various search parties, Pearl's head was never found. Some legends even claim that Jackson and Walling were both offered life sentences instead of execution if they revealed the location of Pearl's head. Both men refused. Pearl's father waited for weeks before he allowed his daughter's remains to be buried without her missing head, but he eventually reconciled himself to the idea that it would never be found. Her coffin was removed from a temporary vault and was taken to her final resting place. And with that, Pearl's sad and tragic journey had finally come to an end. But if there was ever a ghost who was doomed to spend eternity in search of something, it would be the spirit of Pearl Bryan. And if the stories are to be believed, that's exactly what she continues to do well over a century after her death. Just a short distance away from the orchard where Pearl was discovered was an abandoned slaughterhouse that had been built in the 1850s. For years, it was one of the largest in the region, but at the time of Pearl's death, it was empty and had been closed for some years. And while rumors spread that her missing head might have been tossed into a well on the property, it was never recovered or even searched. Why? Well, the stories say that locals were too afraid of her ghost. It was said that Pearl's restless and unhappy spirit haunted the building and the farm around it for many years, even after the structure was torn down in the 1920s. And this officially ended the story of Pearl Bryan, although her legend lives on today, both as a tragic tale of a murdered young woman and her restless spirit, and as a cautionary tale from a time to which we will hopefully never return. Thanks again for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like this show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows on the network and recommend them to friends, family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. If you do have thoughts or comments about American Nightmares, leave us a review or text your comments to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. As a thank you, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, a Haunted America conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really a small business that's grateful for all your support. We couldn't and we wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. As long as the devil doesn't get you first.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network. This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.